We've got a quorum, so let's call the meeting to order for the State Government Finance Division. Representative Hewitt, do you get a chance to read the minutes?
I have, and so moved, Mr. Chair.
Motions have been made to approve the minutes of March 29th, 2019. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Acum. And if you want to move your bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to present House File 2746.
And you want to make the motion?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you did, and I was agreeing to it. Sorry. I move that House File 2746 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that. And committee members, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 2746 today. The bill appropriates $750,000 per year in the coming biennium for the Minnesota Historical Society to continue its digital preservation and access initiative. The Minnesota Historical Society has been in existence for over 170 years with the mission of preserving, sharing, and connecting all of us to our history. This bill will bring their work into the digital age by building upon efforts currently underway that were authorized by the legislature previously. The Digital Preservation and Access Project has helped to make historical collections available to Minnesotans statewide while also preserving these important resources for future generations. This is an immense project given the volume of information that the Historical Society holds in the public trust, and I hope you will support this effort and this bill. And I have with me today David Kelleher, who's the Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Historical Society, and Jennifer Jones, also with the Historical Society, that can further explain the project.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm David Kelleher with the Minnesota Historical Society. Mr. Chair, thank you for taking a few minutes from the committee's time to hear this bill, and thank you to Representative Acum for sponsoring this bill and bringing it forward for the committee's consideration. Mr. Chair, we're going to spare you from the PowerPoint this evening, but we did leave a copy in your folder in case there are any folks who want to do a deeper dive with some of the terminology, and we are happy to spend time with you individually to talk about this. We love talking about this, but we won't do that here tonight. And also, Mr. Chair, we would be really, really excited to take individual members or the committee on a tour of this work in the History Center where this work is happening and where the public accesses the information in the library, and you can see how this can be accessed just about anywhere someone has a computer. We have been collecting evidence of Minnesota's past for nearly 170 years, and the nature of how we preserve and make accessible that material has shifted radically in the last 20 to 30 years. This shift has taken place both in the way that materials are created, some of the materials we collect are described as born digital, as well as how the public expects to access materials, both paper and digital. So this project is based on goals of better preserving materials for future use, as well as making the access better, more convenient, and more effective. We appreciate the support provided by the legislature in this current biennium for this project, and this has really helped to give us the ability to make great strides on this effort. But unfortunately, the funding was one time only, so we are back looking for some continuation of this funding. Mr. Chair, Jennifer Jones, our Deputy Director of Preservation and Outreach, is going to tell you a little bit more about what we've done in this biennium and what we hope to do in the future. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jennifer Jones. I am the Deputy Director for Preservation and Outreach at the Historical Society. We digitize a wide range of materials at the Minnesota Historical Society, but the two biggest categories in both size and complexity are newspapers and manuscripts. Each category illustrates different aspects of the challenges facing us as preservation and access demands have changed over the past few decades. Newspapers are a particularly important part of our collecting mission since our foundations. It is a statutory requirement that every qualified newspaper in the state of Minnesota, which is to say any newspaper that publishes public records, is required to send us a copy of that paper for preservation. And as a result, Minnesota has one of the largest and most comprehensive collections of newspapers that anyone in the rest of the country has. Anybody who works with newspapers is known for over a century that it is impossible to collect newspaper in paper format forever. And so since the 1930s, we've used microfilm to convert and save newspapers. But in the last 15 years, we've shifted all of that preservation to digital. Most of the newspaper we receive when they come into the Historical Society now are converted to digital format upon their arrival. And we have a few arrangements with publishers where they send us the newspaper in digital format just to save time. Other records run the gamut from state archives to the records of state government, including, for example, the papers of the governor's office, and other records that come to us for permanent preservation according to agency retention schedules. Our manuscript collections are rich in business records, such as the Great Northern Railroad and 3M, and we routinely acquire the records of private individuals and public servants who've made an impact on Minnesota. For decades, students, scholars, and family historians have had to come to the Minnesota Historical Society Library to access these materials and to do their research with the paper files. And the systems work fairly well. But we all know about the digital revolution and the way technology has changed our lives in every way, where now a seemingly infinite amount of information can be held on your cell phone. And so what this means is not only has it changed the way that information can be accessed, but it's fundamentally changed the way people expect to access it. Meeting the demands of our current generation of researchers through technology is no small task. So in the first phase of this project, we've completed planning, equipment acquisition, process design, and workflow testing, and we're all now able to scan our newspapers at production level capacity. And what that means is that we're able to scan nearly a million pages a year. Not only does that let us keep up with the 500,000 pages a year that are published in Minnesota, but also we're able to do a backlog of 200,000 to 400,000 pages a year. We've also begun scanning archival materials and developed processes for sucking materials to digitize from our nearly 100,000 cubic feet of paper records. What we hope to accomplish with the requested funding in the upcoming biennium will be to continue to scan this material and make it accessible to Minnesotans and others others interested in Minnesota history, no matter where they live. And fundamentally, what this means is that we can really expand our reach for Minnesotans statewide instead of just being able to serve the 23,000 people who come to our library every year in St. Paul. The challenges we face do not end once we've scanned materials. Since technology is changing all the time, we need to ensure that these materials will not only be accessible to today's researchers, but for the next generations as well. This is why we never talk about access without also talking about the challenges of long-term preservation. Digital preservation encompasses a wide range of activities requiring investments not just in technology, but also in the professional expertise of specially trained archivists. Finally, an additional benefit of this project is to make the best use of the space we have at the Minnesota Historical Society. Many of you have probably been on a behind-the-scenes tour of the History Center and seen the archive storage that we have in the underground levels. In the 27 years that we have been at the History Center, we have managed to fill that archival storage space to capacity. We collect nearly 2,000 new boxes of manuscripts a year, and we are now in the process of consistently trying to figure out which boxes are used the least so that we can store them off-site. Relying on digital access rather than physical access means we can store paper files off-site, reducing the storage burden in the building, freeing up storage spaces for other purposes, while also extending access to people all over Minnesota. It's an investment we think is well worth making. The urgency of continuing this project is that materials are being created digitally every day, and all are at risk of loss if we don't develop the capacity to run an ongoing digital preservation program. So I'll leave you with a quote from Vince Cerf, who is a former top manager at Google and one of the internet pioneers. And a few years ago, he made news because he talked about the fact that everything that we do today somehow worked through technology, our communications, our entertainment. And he said, if we don't find a solution to preservation, our 21st century will be an information black hole. Future generations will wonder about us, but they will have a very great difficulty knowing about us. Mm-hmm. And that is why we think this is a key strategic priority for the Minnesota Historical Society. Thank you.
So, Matt, as we're moving forward, we're not going to be storing the music on 8-track tapes, and we're not going to be using laser discs. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a few questions for the testifiers. Some of them you already answered. Liz, apparently you are going to save the paper copies, which is probably very wise, but do you have adequate storage for those, not only what you have, but those that continue to come in?
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the only paper that we routinely throw away are the newspapers, and that is because it's very low-quality paper. It's not worth saving anyway, and it's a century-old practice. Everybody's done that. Otherwise, you are correct. We are not throwing away the originals. What we are able to do, however, is we can store them off-site, and if you have access digitally, it doesn't matter where we store them, so that we can store some of them at 1500, which is our off-site storage. And this gets a little technical, but if you don't have to provide a box of papers for the public, you can actually pack them tighter, so that a cubic foot of papers that needs to be delivered to the public might be a cubic and a half worth of space, that, or a quarter of that that you would take up in actual storage. We can put more papers into the boxes, and that helps us save space. So yes, we do believe we have enough space to continue to store papers for quite some time.
Representative Green.
Thank you for that answer. The other question is then, digital is great and it's out there, but there's also the concern of losing it as well. Is there adequate safety measures to protect the digital files?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Jones.
Representative, yes, this is the essence of digital preservation, and that it is a specialized task, and the aspects that go into that are always looking for the places where we might run into loss because of technical obsolescence. And so as part of the professional practice, we make sure that the files that we have on computers are checked for errors on a regular basis. We pay attention to when file standards change so that we can migrate. We are always staying ahead of technology changes, and that's essentially part of the practice that's worked into digital preservation.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How about, I know that Minnesota has its own laws for the impaired, but when it comes to storing and be able to view the digital, is there stuff in there that would comply with the ADA laws?
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we can get back to you on the specifics, but we make every effort to comply with accessibility guidelines for ADA on our website, so that we do comply with more extensive descriptions that go along with our photographs and other aspects that make the web more accessible. But as I said, I am not an expert in that. We would have to get you more information.
Representative Green.
Well, thank you. Just one more question then, and this is the simple one. You've had some funding in the past. Looks like we're looking at another 100 or $1.5 billion over the next 2 years. And you've said that you're getting about half of what you can do in every year. How many more years do you think before you can catch up so that we can level off and just get the new stuff coming in?
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we stopped our newspaper microfilming in 2009 during the economic turndown, and what happened then was we developed about because we had some newspapers that hadn't yet been scanned from previous years, we developed about an 11-year backlog. And so at our current rate of newspapers, we are currently working on making sure that all newspapers that come in every year are scanned. So we are no longer digging the hole any deeper. And we should be able to do anywhere from about 60% to a full year of backlog catch up each year. So we don't think it is a terribly long term. We ought to be able to catch up fairly soon.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, question for you. From a archiving newspapers, and you get everyone from the state, there's a lot of things that are the same story in each newspaper. Are you deduplicating those, so removing that story from, say, let's use 20 papers, and you're just keeping it from one and using a call to that other story from the one, many of the other papers? Are you doing anything like that, or is it just lots and lots of storage being dedicated towards the one-to-one?
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we look at the digitization by title. So yes, there would be duplication, I suppose, but we don't think about it that way. We do each title in its entirety. When a newspaper comes in, we scan all of it, including the advertisements, and save that newspaper as it was published by the publisher on a given day.
Okay. Representative Nash.
And, Mr. Chair, to the testifier, can you tell us how much storage you have under management? I'm just, maybe Representative Elkins and I are the only ones that would actually care about this. However, grant us this nerdy moment and maybe tell us what that is, because storage costs money, and I'm just curious as to what you envision full archival storage one day requiring, and then what you're consuming on a yearly basis, and what's that rate of growth?
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am sorry, off the top of my head, I don't have the number. However, I do know that we do know the number, and we have our current amount of
Mr. Kelleher is going to get that for me.
Yes,
I see him writing it down now.
I will tell you that in terms of the way storage costs have been dropping, you may be familiar with the concept of Moore's Law, which is that the amount of storage drops by half in cost over time, and people for years have been predicting the end of Moore's Law, but we are continuing to find that storage is on that trend, that it gets cheaper over time. And we are not finding that storage is actually the most expensive part of our operation.
And Representative Nash, you and I could have them delete everything about you and I, and maybe it would save maybe a little bit of space.
Yeah, well, and Mr. Chair, to the testifier, I worked in storage for 11 years, so I know full well, and in addition to storage and cybersecurity, it's something I think is very fascinating for people to be able to have a digital record of what happened in the state. You know, as a former debater, I used to do debate cases, and you could sort of stare at microfiche until you go blind, and you still don't get a very good story. So I like this being in, stored for posterity for kids hundreds of years from now. So I appreciate it. But if you would give me that, so Representative Elkins and I can have a little nerdgram from you. Appreciate that.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think my main question has been answered. The fact is, while you're putting all of this on digital, you are still saving the main artifacts, which to me are really important, because over the years I have seen technology change. I have tapes that I don't know what to do with, but I love the stuff on it. So I think that's really important, that you're able to accommodate both tasks. So thank you.
Representative Albright.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and testifiers. I'm looking on page 6 and page 8 of your handout, and the first question I have, Mr. Kelleher or to whomever, is paper is very hydroscopic, and I'm just wondering, over time, it tends to get very, very brittle unless it's hermetically sealed or under very strict humidic conditions. So I'm wondering, once you scan it and put it in a more dense location, what are you doing with the papers afterwards? And does that space will never not be necessary to keep the originals? And so are we, I certainly want to be respectful of the written word on paper, but we will continue to add need space just for the originals. That would be a correct assumption. And is that available within the Historical Center, or what will you do with it?
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the vast majority of the spaces that we have are climate controlled appropriately to manage paper long term. It is not difficult for us to find space to put boxes that do not need to be retrieved. Okay. We can rent space. We can put them in another part of the state. We could put them at the University of Minnesota. So once you take the need for people to have immediate access to most of those boxes, finding climate controlled or appropriate space isn't difficult. I would add that not all paper is equal, and there are certain categories of materials, very early state records, the papers of Sibley and Ramsey, papers that might be particularly fragile or important, that we might deem special collections and maintain permanently at the Historical Society. But I would just say, I could probably prove this with data, but I will say impressionistically, of the 100,000 cubic feet of boxes that are currently stored at the History Center, a single box may go years without being retrieved at all. It's a very poor use of important space in the History Center that we could probably make better use of.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're asking for $750,000 in the next 2 years of the biennium. So mechanically speaking, is that for more equipment to speed up and expedite the scanning? Is it for personnel to assist? Can you give us a kind of a broad brush breakdown in terms of what that goes to in terms of expediting the process to completion?
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we spent most of the appropriation in the first 2 years on specialized equipment that we needed to do the work. For example, the pieces of equipment that we used to scan the newspapers, we paid quite a bit of money for because of their speed and their accuracy. And so what we are looking to spend the money on moving forward is making sure that we have enough staff on hand to fully take advantage of the investment that we made. So we can put a couple of shifts a day and run about 10 hours of constant scanning a day if we have enough staff to do that. And that's what really keeps us up with those million, you know, up to a million pages a year. The other costs that we will need to make sure we have covered, it's not a huge portion of the appropriation, but the equipment is not just a one-time cost. There's ongoing maintenance and upgrades and software updates and that type of thing. And so we've estimated a certain percentage of money for those service contracts and software upgrades.
Representative Albright. Representative Wilkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. I want to look back to Representative Green's line of questioning and maybe ask the question in a way you might be able to answer it. So when you scan a newspaper, is the finished product something that you could do, for example, a keyword search on to? It is. So it's probably digitally accessible then.
I see them shaking their head, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So a screen reader could probably pick up read the content.
Ms. Jones.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's absolutely right. I should have been more clear about that. When we scan the newspaper, we don't just get an image of the newspaper. Yep. We get an optical character recognition read of the letters, which converts it into a full text that can be read.
Good. Thank you.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering what type of disaster recovery and mirroring or remote storage do you have for your archived when you digitize? I'm assuming that you don't just have it in one location so that if there's a fire or some, you know, tornado comes through.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. We do full backups of all of our newspaper onto tape, and we store the tapes off-site, so they're not in the same location as our servers that also have the images on them. For many of our other newspapers is our biggest is our biggest consumer of terabytes in terms of space. But for many of our other digital documents, we use cloud storage as well as a backup to what we keep on our servers on site at the History Center.
Representative Flom. Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, to the testifier, I'm just going to bring us back to the basics here. Who has access to this now? Is it members or is it the general public? Who can come into the library or can they get it online? Can you explain to me again?
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So to the extent that we were able to make materials available online publicly and freely, we do. When it comes to newspapers, we always follow the law when it comes to the publisher's copyright rights. And if something is not in the public domain, in other words, it is still in copyright, then you can see it digitally at our library only, unless we have a specific agreement with the publisher that lets us make it more available for more freely. And that's important to us. That's important to when we have discussed it with the Minnesota Newspaper Association. We are in no way giving away publishers' content for free. We are always abiding by copyright law.
Mr. Chair, to the testifier again. So it's available only here in St. Paul. Is that correct?
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if it is in copyright only, if it's out of copyright and that there's a date, so anything that's older than, I believe, 1923 is in the public domain, and we have many pagers that are in the public domain already. But we have to preserve, by statute, all the newspapers that are currently published. So if it's published last year, it's still in copyright, you can come to the History Center and you can look at it, but we can't make it publicly available. All of our other materials that we own free and clear of copyright, our manuscript materials, as we digitize them, we are putting them online.
Okay, Mr. Chair, one last question. So that's available to all our public or private schools or to school kids throughout the state. They can go online and research this through the Minnesota History site. Is that correct then?
Ms. Jones?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. And so with the exception of copyright, we make every effort to make sure that everything we digitize is widely available online through our website.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that brings up the thought. I can imagine there'd be quite a few different entities that would like to do research and have accessibility to some of the copyrighted materials. Has the society ever entered into some sort of an agreement with the the people that have the copyright so that research entities could pay some sort of fee and they would get a portion of it and the Historical Society would get a portion of it, and that would help defer the cost to the public for doing this digitization?
Ms. Jones?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not currently have that situation right now, but we have had conversations in the past with the Minnesota Newspaper Association to try to develop some kind of mutually beneficial arrangement that would let us do some kind of for-profit delivery and revenue splitting. There are early conversations about this, and I would say we were in these conversations 3 or 4 years ago. We're really hampered by the fact that we hadn't at that point made the technology investments yet to be able to do the digitization and then to also provide access. We're a lot closer now, and my guess is that at some point we will begin those conversations again, but we haven't done it yet.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would assume that besides the newspaper associations, you'd also have educational institutions and different other entities, both public and private, that might be interested. Has there been another state that has done this type of arrangement so that you have some guidelines of avoiding the oopses and maximizing the effectiveness? And then if there is there an idea of what type of revenue that might be able to augment the public funding?
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware of any other state that has done this at this scale. Most states don't have an aggregation of newspapers as large as ours, and most states have financial pressures that make it impossible to do this. The biggest example I can give you is the state of Iowa that decided to outsource their newspaper digitization to newspapers.com and turn it into a kind of public-private partnership. But they were also, I believe, dealing with historic in copyright newspapers, which were making available freely. I could be wrong, but I don't think that involved in copyright newspapers.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think to the members on the committee and to the testifiers, this might be an interesting thing to, you know, come before the legislature next year or when we get close. Because I'd like to be able to have the committee and legislature address this option, you know, ahead of time. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while we were discussing this, I used their website and went to 100 years ago today and looked up this Minneapolis Tribune. You might like to know you could get a full set of teeth for $5. You can get a special pump sale of high heel shoes for $4.95, and the new Studebaker is out.
Mr. Heller, you wanted to testify.
Mr. Chair, if I could just quickly mention back to Representative
Mr. Kelleher, yep.
On the last page of the PowerPoint, there are some links to where you can access these materials. The last slide of the handout will take you to the newspaper hub and other places.
That would be nice to get now.
Mr. Heller, please state your name for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rick Heller. Unofficially represent the twice exceptional Minnesota Statute 120B-15 Gifted and Talented Programming, also known in House File 1370 on line 118. Also, the people with print disabilities unofficially found in the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008 with the blind, only two, and then in the IDEA Act of 2004. It's my understanding the librarians in 1931 noticed that these individuals that were cited in the libraries were engaged with the same book on tape as the blind, so they decided not to call them blind. They call them print disabled. That's where that came from. The piece of this is, since this is a library, and I believe the librarians are the ones that decided who were the print disabled. However, Minnesota Statute 16E.03 Subdivision 9 is what state agencies are required to do, which is part of Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, as well as 508. And the smartphones last year started to read out loud for a reason and also be compatible, usable with the internet. It's because it's not that we can read anymore. Can we understand oral English? They go to socialsecurityadministration.gov and you go to the bottom on accessibility and it brings up to the top of the page, which is not mentioned blind or visually impaired for that plugin. But the target audience is learning disability, dyslexia, and English is a second language. What the plugin does is highlights and reads the words as they're read. Once again, it's not that we can read. Can we understand oral English is the goal in America, as expressed in our Constitution, the First Amendment, freedom of speech. I believe this, the word access on line 117 on the bill, which is 2746, could include a policy that they're working toward accessibility based on what state agencies have to do. Currently, the Minnesota Legislature is sitting in a working group 1962 consider accessibility based on, again, 16E.03 subdivision 9, that this would be an appropriate place to place that language. If you go on page 10 of the PowerPoint, hopefully they'll get this to you in a timely manner and accessible with the appropriate software. And it talks about acquire under item bottom slide, acquire items in a digital form, born digital, as well as on page 2 on the bottom of the page. It says continued value remains accessible and usable. Ease in use is really all about individuals as how they acquire the same information, how they engage in the same interaction, and how they enjoy the same services. Once again, that is what accessibility is without people with disabilities. It's the opportunity for everyone to access that information appropriately. It's my suggestion. I will provide this handout to the author as well as the library here, that on page 8 of 9, it's a guideline for accessibility and usability of information technology standards from MINIT, which is the accessibility person for the legislature as well as for state agencies, dated 4/17/18. And if you go to page 9 of 8 of it, specifically says, quote on a second full paragraph, manually tests are critical in accurately assessing accessibility by simulating the user experience. Portable document format, I'm assuming that's some of the software they're using up there, will read out loud. That started in 2001. And in 2008, in their guide from a portable document format, Adobe, specifically on page 9, it mentions best for people with dyslexia and people with print disabilities. Once again, is it that we can read, or is it can we understand? And once again, I stress that as we move ahead to create digital accessibility, and since in 2004, an IDEA Act, they require all the books in Congress to be digitized, starting that that process, and if anybody knows it, but the libraries and the museums are merged now federally, so I don't know what that means as it relates to your process here. But we know that many of the documents from the legislature end up on top of the hill here for this library as well as school districts. So really, unless you manually check your documents, and if you're scanning in documents, how do you know that it reads in order? How important are the images that are not tagged? Because once you scan it in, you took part of the accessibility element out of that picture, and then the captioning as well. So once again, unless you actually manually check your documents, you could be open a can of worms, as far as I'm concerned, as far as functional accessibility for the blind and print disability. So I guess you consider this verbiage in the future, if not today. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Any questions for Mr. Heller? If not, thank you. Anybody else in the audience that wants to speak to this bill?
That's what I said, yes.
Please come on down. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
My name is Stephanie Chapel. I would like to oppose this this funding. It has been done repeated. It's been a kind of a recurring issue, and it's just assumed that it's given. And if it is appropriated for this biennium, I say great, but restrict the Minnesota Historical Society in its nonprofit basis from legacy grants. They've received this portion. Let them work with this portion. If they do not get this appropriation through this year, then allow them to apply for legacy grants under the Minnesota State Historical Society and not a nonprofit.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would she repeat the last sentence, please?
Yes. If you do allow these appropriations to go through or do not go through, allow the Minnesota Historical Society to apply for grants as the Minnesota Historical Society and not their nonprofit status or their state agency status.
Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, members, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Acomb.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Chair, to your committee. Looks like we have House File 2751 teed up. Do you want to introduce your bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 2751 for possible inclusion.
Chair Nelson moves House File 2751 for possible inclusion. And Chair Nelson, you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment?
That's the DE2 amendment.
Yes, the DE2 amendment. Thank you.
And I'll move the DE2 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, with regard to the DE2 amendment, I would move for a division of the amendment.
Okay. What's your division?
Dividing the amendment between lines 1.7 and 1.8. And I would like to take up the first half of the amendment first, and I would request a roll call.
Okay. Representative Albright has requested a roll call. Representative Albright, why don't we let the chair speak to the amendment? Let's let Chair Nelson speak to the amendment, and then we will get to your division.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And what this, the DE2 amendment, what it does is basically cuts off the second year of the funding for this, and instructs the Humanities Centers, the Commissioners of Human Services, the Commissioner of Agriculture to come up with another funding source for this. This is a great program. I have nothing against this program. The trouble is it does not belong in government operations. Our budget is about funding the backbone of government. This is a program that should probably be like the SNAP that it works with, be funded by agriculture or health and human services. And I understand that the history of this is 2 years ago that they were looking for a place to fund this program, and they stuck it in this budget and going forward, but it should really be with the other parts of government that provides these services so that they can be coordinated with the other programs that are similar to this. And that's the point of the bill, and that's the point of the amendment. And like I said, we're going to fund it the first year and instruct the administration to come up with money to fund it in the appropriate place in the upcoming years.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Nelson. With that,
Mr. Chair, if I could speak to the amendment as well.
Yes, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I think that a number of considerations surround the bill as well as the amendment. And let me just point out a couple. First off, the governor has fully funded this program at the $650,000 level. I'm not speaking to the intent of the author of the amendment, but I'm at sorts in terms of trying to find out why there was a reduction. I've had conversations with the Minnesota Humanities Center. They do not object to continue to facilitate being the fiscal agent on this. I think one of the other things that we've observed, I serve on HHS policy. I've served on both committees for a number of years. For an appropriation of this nature to run through DHS or even for that matter, the Ag Department, it's going to get lost in their budget. And it, in some cases, the facility from an efficiency standpoint of running it through their operations certainly would require or ask of them, they would ask of the appropriation a much larger amount than is being asked of by the Minnesota Humanities Center to facilitate the appropriation itself. So from that standpoint, we're trying to, in the very real sense, provide folks with healthy food. And I can't think of a better program to do on as an efficient manner as possible. We've got, as has been announced, a $102 million target, and to reduce the budget for this by $325,000. Not to suggest that this is trying to fit it inside the target, but I don't see the need for it. There have been oppositions aplenty to this that have come into my office. I understand that several organizations, coalitions, oppose this for the purpose of the reasons I've just cited, providing healthy food for people who need it the most. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to take up the first half of the divided amendment.
Chair Nelson, do you want to speak to the divided, the proposal for the divided amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, the motion is to divide it. We can vote on the first half, and then we can vote on the second half.
Okay. At that, we'll take the roll.
Is the roll on the motion to divide or on the first half?
First.
Okay. Roll call vote on the first half of the amendment.
As divided.
As divided. Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Akam?
Yes.
Representative Elkins?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Hertas?
No.
Representative Hewitt? Representative Keel?
No.
Representative Cleborne?
Yes.
Representative Lippert?
Yes.
Representative Long?
Yes.
Representative Mason?
Yes.
Representative Nash? Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Quam?
Nay.
Representative Vogel?
No, who's that? So with 11 ayes and 7 noes, the first half of the division passes. Representative Albright, to the second half of your division.
Mr. Chair, the second half of the amendment is to the author, so I would let him deem what is appropriate for the remainder of that amendment.
Thank you, Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and members, I would ask for support of the second half. Again, to get the governor's staff, the Commissioner of Agriculture, the Commissioner of Health and Human Services to work without coming up with a way to fund this going forward in the appropriate committee. Like I said, the SNAP program, which this is tied to, food stamps, is in agriculture. It's kind of an appropriate place for them so they can coordinate this instead of having little programs all over the place that aren't coordinated together, and that would be a more appropriate place to fund this. Again, the state government finance bill is about funding state government and about funding the backbone of state government so that all these other programs can work the way they can. It's not about running programs like this, and it's not the appropriate place for this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no.
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 The motion to second half of the amendment passes. And I'm guessing now we do the entire bill as amended. Okay, so the entire bill as amended.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Keel.
I would like to submit DE1.
Yes. Let's get through the DE2 first, and we'll get to your amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Albright.
In fairness to the folks who have come to talk to the bill, and I know that we're probably belaboring the point on here, but might I suggest that we take testimony first and then move to the DE1?
Absolutely, Representative Albright. It was our thinking. We would put this in the shape that the author would like it, and then we will take public testimony before getting to the DE1. Representative Keel, acceptable? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. All right. To the DE2 amendments. Oh, we did. Yes. Okay. So,
testify.
Okay. Chair Nelson, final comments on the amendment.
No, we just took care of it. Mr. Chair, I think now we should move to the testify. Is there people here wanting?
Okay, we are. Okay. With that, we do have a list of testifiers. First is Ms. Colleen Moriarty. You could come speak. Introduce yourself for the record. And we do have a list of testifiers, so if you can keep your testimony 2-3 minutes, we'd very much appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is actually Leah Gardner. I am also with Hunger Solutions Minnesota, standing in for Colleen Moriarty. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the Healthy Eating Here at Home Grant, more widely known as the Market Box Program. We are very concerned about the proposed elimination of funds in House File 2751. The program leverages up to a $10 match on SNAP EBT customers' purchases at participating farmers markets. It's an incredibly popular program, nationally recognized for its innovation in making healthy, locally grown food available to those struggling to make ends meet. Since Hunger Solutions took on administering Market Box, the program has grown to include 99 market locations in all parts of the state. The program is a great cross-sector collaboration. With state funding, we've leveraged the enthusiasm of local farmers markets and small growers into a robust program. The small businesses and nonprofits, along with government, are truly making a difference in the lives and diets of low-income Minnesotans. Farmers markets report that customers spent over $346,000 in Market Box and SNAP benefits during the last farmers market season. It's a win-win-win for Minnesotans. Customers win by being able to stretch their buying power at farmers markets, making fresh local food more affordable for low-income residents. Farmers win because Market Box brings them new customers that may not otherwise be able to shop at farmers markets. Approximately 7,000 SNAP customers shopped at participating farmers markets as a result of Market Box outreach, and many customers continue to visit the markets then throughout the summer. And communities win because of increased economic activity. USDA research estimates that for every dollar of SNAP benefits spent, we create $1.79 in economic activity in the community. So by using that number, SNAP and Market Box spending this last season resulted in over $619,000 in economic activity. Threats to elimination of market-based solutions to hunger like Market Box are short-sighted. Removing the ability of low-income individuals to buy healthy local food at farmers markets forces them to purchase and eat less healthy foods and rely more on food shelves. As it stands, food shelves are pushed to capacity right now, serving over 300 million visits annually. Individuals using Market Box have come to count on this program to help them afford fresh foods that they want to be healthy. Farmers markets see it as central to their ability to be accessible to all members of the community. The timing of this bill is of great concern to all of us, given that we're only 1 month away from the beginning of the season. The process for gearing up has already begun. While we appreciate the opportunity to continue advocating for the program's future funding in whatever committee may be best, we are counting on your leadership to ensure that a solution is identified and that the resources are maintained. We urge you to do all that you can to preserve funding for healthy eating here at home. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gardner. I appreciate your testimony. If we could proceed with the rest of the testifiers before we get to member questions, since we do have a list here. Thank you. Next, I have Jessica Webster. If you could introduce yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. Also here with concerns about this bill and the amendment. I want to thank Representative Nelson for meeting with us, and he was kind of open to having this conversation and hearing these concerns. And to those of you who also have been hearing us out, I was part of a small group also with Hunger Solutions Minnesota, MaZone, Jewish Response to End Hunger, and the Minnesota Farmer Markets Association that helped create this bill. And where where this program really came from was a push from members of both parties to low-income advocates to say that they wanted people to be eating healthier food. And one of the things that we would say is, just because you want someone to eat healthy strawberries or healthy apples or healthy broccoli and cauliflower and peppers, it doesn't always mean that they have the resources to pay for those things. And so this, we worked with Representative Sarah Anderson to create this program that is a win-win for both low-income families and seniors and people who need food, and also farmers and our local foods movement. And so it's a very strong program. You know, I have concerns that this bill was introduced, Representative, last Thursday. That doesn't give advocates any time to make the case for this program in the Ag or Health and Human Services committees. By delaying it a year, I think that's helpful. But again, then you're teeing us up in a supplemental year, where often the message to advocates is come back in the first year of a budget year. So I think it would be even more helpful if this was funded for a biennium, and you could come back. We could come back in the first year of the next biennium to advocate in front of those committees that you would prefer it to be in front of. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. Next, I have Kathy Zeman. Hello. If you could introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the division, I'm Kathy Zeman. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Farmers Market Association, and I'm a grass livestock farmer just an hour south down by Northfield, little town of Nerstrand. Thank you for letting me testify about Market Bucks. Others will speak tonight about the food value of Market Bucks and SNAP, and my comments are going to illustrate the economic value to the farming and the food makers community about Market Bucks, and all of that they bring to the 99-plus communities in Minnesota whose farmers markets accept SNAP and Market Bucks. As with most federal and state monies that come to the tiny but mighty programs, these dollars all stay in our local communities. This is not international, global ag at all. It is tiny and mighty programs here in Minnesota. And these investments have a remarkably high return on investment for Minnesotans. SNAP and Market Bucks flow to the participants that then flow directly to your food farmers and your food makers. And a little bit of that administration money goes to the farmers markets themselves in order to put on these programs, because it's a cost to the market. The SNAP participants win, and the food makers and the food farmers win, but the market itself has to come up with money to support these. And all of that money then gets turned around and gets spent in the local communities. Three of the four markets who see the highest SNAP and Market Buck redemptions are in Minneapolis and St. Paul. But then it quickly branches out to Rochester, Grand Rapids, St. Cloud, Marshall, Lincoln Park, up in Duluth, Hibbing and Laverne, and on throughout the state. I'd like to highlight the Grand Rapids Farmers Markets tonight as a great example. It's a farmers market that is usually fourth or fifth as far as redemption for Market Bucks and SNAP in the state. It's a town of roughly 11,000 people in a county, Itasca County, of about 45,000 people, and yet they're fourth or fifth in the state for Market Buck and SNAP redemptions. In 2018, they handed out a little over $28,000 in SNAP and Market Bucks, with an average of $2,089 flowing to the 14 food farmers and food makers in that community. That was a significant amount of income for those farmers and food makers. Additionally, because they offered SNAP and Market Bucks at their market, they welcomed 93 new SNAP participants to their market just last year. Because SNAP participants, of course, are not static, they flow in and out. So 93 more just in Grand Rapids alone. If we take a deeper look at the Grand Rapids farmers markets, it's worth noting that the market doubled the impact of the $10 because they came up with money within their own community, and they call it the Mighty Matching Bucks. So a SNAP participant in Grand Rapids would spend $10 and get $20 more in incentives. So for $10, they ended up with $30 of local food that all stays in that community because of this program. So if we can't get Market Bucks funded this year and continually every year, this year in particular, you know, the seeds are already bought. There's millions of trays of transplants in greenhouses right now. The chickens are ordered, the feed's in the, you know, in the feed bins. We've got market dates already set up with all the meat plants to butcher all the animals. All of this local food for farmers in the state of Minnesota is already in the supply pipeline. And if this can't get funded, then that all stops. And that stops income and whatever profitability these farmers might have and the food makers might have. So this is really important in all of these communities throughout the state of Minnesota. If And again, you know, it would be those 14, just in Grand Rapids alone, it would be 14 food farmers and food makers that don't get their $2,000 this year. That could be a difference of profitability. And if you multiply that across Minnesota, just as Leah said, it means that local communities will lose roughly $346,000 in their local communities, which then is will sacrifice just shy of $620 of additional economic activity. So these little tiny programs have a broad return on investment for Minnesotans. I admit that I do not know all the competing funding needs that this committee, this division faces. I appreciate your diligence in balancing the wants and the needs in your budget. I just know that losing market buck funding at this late date would put a tremendous hurt on a lot of people in greater Minnesota and throughout the state. So I appreciate you allowing me to testify tonight, and I wish you good luck making your decisions.
Thank you, Ms. Zima. Appreciate your testimony. Next we have, Leah Porter is next.
Welcome.
You could introduce yourself and begin with your testimony.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Leah Porter. I'm the director of the Twin Cities Mobile Market at the Wilder Foundation based here in St. Paul. We are a mobile grocery store using a converted Metro Transit bus that sells foods at below market prices in food deserts and low food access areas across the Twin Cities. We are addressing the access issue. After 4 years of service, we've learned that affordability is actually the number one barrier that people face in being able to eat healthy foods. For example, we serve a lot of seniors, as well as families. The average SNAP benefit per month for the seniors that we serve, for example, is $16 a month. So think about how far $16 would get you. I bet many of you have spent more on that for lunch today. So if you have such a limited income for your family or for yourself, and you have to choose between an apple, which is going to be a dollar itself, or a box of mac and cheese or some other cheaply processed boxed food, that's going to get, you know, more calories for yourself, but it's not necessarily going to be nutritious calories or healthy food. You're going to go with the cheaper processed food. That's why Market Bucks is so huge, because it really stretches people's SNAP dollars to be able to afford fruits and vegetables that they normally wouldn't be able to afford. This program is huge for the people we serve. Most of the people we serve are on SNAP. They get very few benefits, as I mentioned. They save up their market bucks. So once their benefits are out after their one shopping trip, they have market bucks that they can use the rest of the month to be able to eat healthy foods. So I guess I just urge you to think thoughtfully and responsibly about how to transition this program if it is transitioned, because I can tell you that eliminating it will be devastating for the families we serve. It will literally be taking food out of their mouths. So please consider that. I urge you to please preserve this funding. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Porter. The last person I have on my list is Maya Ulysses. Hi, please introduce yourself and
sure.
Proceed with your testimony.
My name is Mia Ulysses. I am the policy manager at an organization based in North Minneapolis called Appetite for Change, if any of you have ever heard of us, or dined at our restaurant called Breaking Bread Cafe and Catering. We operate West Broadway Farmers Market, which is going to be going into its seventh season this year, which has been previously carried by the West Broadway Business and Area Coalition. It serves about 12,000 customers each season out of the 60,000 residents that are based in North Minneapolis. And the unique part about the work that we do at Appetite for Change is that we have a strong intersectional approach to the solutions that we provide in our community. Our organization was started by three women of color who were looking at the community in North Minneapolis and noticed that there were Popeyes and there were Hook's Fish and Chips and McDonald's and Wendy's up and down the streets, but there wasn't a place that you could take your wife out to go for a date. There wasn't a place that you could have a meeting to set up a business proposition. And a lot of the work that we've done over the past 7 years has been really looking at our food system and engaging our community members in the solutions that they have requested in their community. So really taking on this for us, by us, community-based approach. We have three workshops called Community Cooks, one for new and expectant mothers where they are provided a meal and child care that is provided through our elders and our youth, and they learn how to care and nourish their bodies as they're going through postpartum. We have one for youth aged 14 to 24 where they're, you know, usually just kicking it in the kitchen, listening to hip-hop music and trying foods that maybe they've never tried before, and we have one for our general community members. It's a way where we can feed thousands of mouths throughout the year and really have a community-based conversation on what it looks like to live in a food desert and what it looks like for people that have lived in food deserts and still currently live in food deserts to be looking at approaches to how they're fighting these solutions. And the West Broadway Farmers Market has been an amazing asset to the Northside community. We have the Lindell Farmers Market, which is probably the closest large-scale farmers market you might see that serves predominantly the downtown, North Loop, uptown, affluent area. But what is really unique about the West Broadway Farmers Market is that it's not just a space to convene to be able to procure food, but it's a space for people to come and learn how to cook the produce that they're purchasing. It's a space for them to listen to music. It's a space for them to take their toddlers on a summer day. It's a space for people to really build community. And something that has been really crucial and essential to the West Broadway Farmers Market success is the Market Box program. It's, to Leah's point, an opportunity for people who have low opportunities and options to be able to procure fresh produce, to be able to stretch those dollars so that when the produce is made accessible to them, they have an opportunity to afford it. So just to keep it short, I would encourage you and urge you to fund this to the fullest extent in the biennium, at the very least giving the Hunger Solutions and other advocates time to be able to reconsider what this might look like. We believe that food is a human right. It should be the backbone of government infrastructure. So the way that the program currently is seated, I think that those that have testified today could agree that we believe it's in the perfect position. But we are trying to advocate and continue to push through this funding to make sure that we can feed the communities that really need it the most.
Thank you, Ms. Ulysses. I am familiar with the West Broadway Farmers Market, and it's a, it's a smashing success. So.
Thank you.
So it's a, it truly is a community gathering place. That completes my list of testifiers that have signed up. Any other members from the audience that would wish to speak to this, wish to speak to this bill? Mr. Heller, you could introduce yourself again for the tape and keep your testimony 2 to 3 minutes.
My name is Rick Heller, unofficial representative of Twice Exceptional People with Print Disabilities. I'd like to speak on DE2 Pacific. Since the Minnesota Department of Humanities Center is the ones that are in consultation with Human Services and Agriculture, they are the ones that must submit the report. Currently, reports that are coming back from the Minnesota Humanities Center is not accessible unless you put this in here, Minnesota Statute 16E, Subdivision 9. They will likely will not be accessible. That's a suggestion I have for this, and I appreciate that they're going to get a report back, hopefully more accessible than any others. And thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. I'm told that we can convert these into accessible documents so they will be available.
I was talking about the report that the Humanities Center, that the reports that they do to the legislature. I believe the Humanities Center is part of the Native Americans, which is one of our commissions. I believe we have four ethic councils. That's one of them. They are not compliant. And unless... And even though it's a state agency, believe it or not, quasi, you know, it's something to think about in the future as you continue to generate these reports that are coming back here that are not functionally accessible with the Adobe Reader. Thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Helen. That's point is noted. Other testifiers to the bill? I see two. You want to go ahead? You're the closest. Yeah. First come, first serve.
You want to come down, you can come sit.
Hi there. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Abigail Renteria. I work with Second Harvest Heartland as a SNAP outreach specialist. Thanks for taking time to listen to us. I just think the last thing to be said that hasn't already been said is the individual families would be affected if the program were changed. I've worked with a lot of families in the last year that have just mentioned now that they're signed up for SNAP, they've been able to eat fresh fruits and vegetables that hasn't been an option for their family before, and meeting them at the food shelf, and they had been receiving a lot of processed foods. She just met one specific family I'm thinking of just mentioned how much weight their family had gained in the 6 months that they've been visiting the food shelf since her husband had been disabled. So no bad thing towards food shelves. They're doing the best they can. But this program is so important for families to maintain their health. And it's even fun. It's a way to introduce their kids to, different lifestyle, different shopping, different eating habits. And reiterate that this program is so important for families and at the family level, each individual could be affected if it were discontinued. So I just urge you to either transition it to another department or just continue it. So thank you.
Thank you. I caught Abigail. Could you repeat your last name again?
Renteria.
Renteria.
I want to spell it for me.
Renteria.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, sir.
Hi. Sir, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is David Katsonis. I am the director of the St. Paul Growers Association. My organization runs 26 separate farmers markets over the course of the year. About a dozen of them accept EBT SNAP benefits. I see my role as bridging the gap between our communities and our local growers. So there's been a lot of good things said about the Market Bucks program, so I don't need to say the same things, but I really want to ask that you keep it funded. This program works. It's enhancing the lives of our local growers, supporting them, and it's adding to the health of our communities and the wealth of our communities too. By keeping the money local, we're building the wealth of all the communities in addition to the health. I would like to see it continually funded. To interrupt the funding is to interrupt the lives of our growers and interrupt the lives of the community members. I'm actually at these markets. I've been with St. Paul for 2 years. Prior to that, I was in Rochester, so I've been working with the Market Bucks program firsthand since 2011. It's a great program. It really is working. It's affecting the lives of both these groups. I was at a market in Rochester, and this family came in, and it was a mom with three kids. And the oldest one walked by my information booth, and I've got a sandwich board out front, and it says EBT on the sandwich board. And the oldest daughter, probably 8, maybe 10 years old, she points at the letters EBT, and she says, "Eat better things." And this program is working. It's enhancing the lives of our community members. And please keep it funded. Once it stops, it's hard to get it going again. We've already got our advertising dollars in. We're already promoting these markets, and we just need to keep this funded. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cosadas. Appreciate your testimony today. Any other testifiers? Okay, with that, we can move to member questions, comments.
You have a list?
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Keel. See, this is why Jim keeps me in check. Representative Keel, you have the DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to submit the DE1 amendment. Members, this is a good program. We're talking about $325,000 each year, 2020 and 2021, that is appropriated. I've sat on both Health and Human Services and the Ag Committee. And for one, the Ag budget is very small, and it does some services of food. But I think this is a great place for this program to be. It is very well funded. Funding, and it is most of the dollars are sent toward the actual program and not the running of it. That gets very concerning when you put it into places like Health and Human Services. I fear it would get lost and all of a sudden be moved to something else. But as you've heard from our testifiers, this fresh produce and this program is very important to our friends and neighbors. The economic value, I mean, look at the program entirely. It feeds people. It provides access. I notice when I'm in different areas, there's different nationalities, as there is with baking. You know, I go into a more Czechoslovakian area in my district, and I've eaten some nice little pastries that I had never been exposed to before. And that's great, and that's very much appreciated. But there are a lot of things that happen in these food markets with Market Box and the Market Box program that really access and put people food and access to food into different people. We've heard great comments about this. I notice I've got a map here. I should have probably ran it off for everybody. It really serves a lot of Minnesota. It's not so much in my district, actually, but Representative Green has some areas that are very successful. One of them is connected to the White Earth Reservation. And I guess it's in Manoman, and there's another one in Bagley at Clearwater County, but not just that. All over the state, there's huge. It's just in huge markets. Some are very large, some are smaller. And as someone pointed out, this is really just getting going. And I think this is the appropriate place to put it. Not to mention the fact that we're at the end of hearing bills, so it would be very difficult to put it into another committee. And I'm actually a little frustrated. Back when a couple years ago when the state government finance bill was accessible, there was a $90 million cut and 2 years ago, and we still kept this program running. We're talking about very little money in a state budget, and I just really think this is a good program, very important to people, and it really provides them with access to food, and actually I think a variety of things that maybe some of our children have never been had access to or even known about, different vegetables. So, and I think it's a great, I know it is a great economic value because buying fresh produce fills a kid faster than a lot of other things that they can be eating. And it really makes our SNAP program, our EBT program, successful. And with that amendment, I would also like to request a roll call, excuse me.
Okay, has requested roll call. Before we get to roll call and Chair Nelson's comments, I have a few names here. Are any other members have questions to the amendment? Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I got a list of the cities that this is located in, and I can pass this around if you don't have it. But I want to tell you a story. I was dropping off a guest at the airport in St. Paul, and I have a weird hobby. I like to smoke meat in competitive circuits, and one of the main ingredients is homemade chipotle. So I buy jalapeno peppers and hot peppers literally by the bushel. So I thought, hey, I'm at the airport, I'm near St. Paul, I'm gonna go shopping. So I went to several of the St. Paul locations in this Zenic quest to buy as many jalapeno peppers as my arms could carry, and I did. And one of the things that I noticed as I was walking around is that there were people using this program. And they were using it to great effect. People who were walking with their kids, some of the cutest kids I've seen, other than my own, of course, are with their parents probably shopping for some vegetables and produce that they may have never seen before. So I want to urge you to be very careful in how you vote for this amendment, because it's gonna have great impact. I mean, you look at this list; it's all over the state, everywhere. There is not a corner of our state that does not have some market in proximity to this program. And I just think I have heard from actually some of you talking about issues around food justice. I've heard issues about that and food deserts. And I listened. Bet you didn't think I listened, but I did.
if we cut this program, you've heard it from the people who have come to testify. You've heard how important this is to them. You've heard from farmers who have banked on this program being in existence, and they've already laid out cash for seedlings and livestock and other things. This is an important issue. And I want to remind you, for those of you who served on state government finance with me in the last number of years, I'm not exactly spendy, but I was happy to make sure that this stayed going in perpetuity. This is important. And there are people, think of the kids that I've described going along the farmers markets with their parents. And I will tell you, if you've never been to a, I'm sure you've been to a farmers market, but farmers at the farmers market typically overpack the bags because that's just who they are. So not only are they getting a good deal, but they're also getting over and above because that's kind of what farmers do. I have a community full of farmers, and they do this very same thing. And the folks at the Second Harvest Heartland who talked about that really touched a chord with me because I know a lot of those farmers who in my district will go to farmers markets and then they come back and they'll donate to the Waconia United Food Shelf. And if you've been to my office or on the third floor and you've walked by the, we call it the art gallery, but if you walk by that area, you've seen that I have a box out there for the food shelf. Now, what we also do, my wife and my kids and I have several friends who have apple trees. And we go and we pick those apple trees sometimes until I'm all the way in the top of the tree picking apples. And you know what we do with them? We wash them and then we get them to the food shelf. That's something that I volunteer to do. These people don't have the time or the resources to volunteer to do that. They need this program, so do not take this vote lightly. Think about it as you're going down this road because this is an important program to save. Again, if you need to pass this around, I'm happy to do so. It's everywhere, every single corner of our state, and I would encourage you to adopt the DE1.
Thank you, Representative Nashman. If you want to pass that around, we can get that to this other members to take a look at. Representative Quam, did you have questions, comments on the DE1 amendments?
Yes.
Okay. Wasn't sure if you were questions for the amendment or for the final bill.
Well, the intent of this amendment is pretty clear. And frankly, what you need to ask, is this a bad program? Should we get rid of this program or should we kill this program? I don't think this is a bad program. And anyone that's voting to take the funds away from it, I'd like to understand why you think this is a bad program. If you think this is a good program, why should you be voting to cut it? Do you think maybe there's something better to do? When I look at this without the amendment, I see taking money away from a program. I've heard a little bit that, you know, it should be in this area or that area. Well, have a solution. Don't kill the program and then hope for, you know, a better thing forward. Have the better thing before you, you know, change this program.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Any other questions to the DE1 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Food deserts? I mean, in a state where our per capita is well north of, on a family basis, $80,000, and we're talking about food deserts? And we're talking about food deserts in places like Eagan and Golden Valley and Minnetonka and Bloomington and Brooklyn Park and Duluth, and we're talking about food deserts? And I'm reminded of when I used to drive between Apple Valley and Cannon Falls, and I would go out County Road 42 past the old ammunition facility. You know what that is now? That's a truck grocery facility for immigrants to grow fresh produce that they grow to the point of some of the testifiers, and they bring that into the farmers markets on Saturdays and whenever, and that's their livelihood. But it's also the livelihood for the people that go there with these bucks. You are, in a sense, taking a program and out of a desire to move it away from the Humanities Center to another agency, which will do it gladly, probably, but for more money. They will take a bigger ding out of the appropriation, which means that for every $10 that they use, you're taking $10 out of someone's pocket to buy fresh produce for someone who might not otherwise eat that week or have to go on being nutritionally fed by a box of mac and cheese or something that, you know, has empty calories. We don't even have literally a funding problem because this is already in the base. And to Representative Keel's amendment, we're just trying to preserve the base. Representative Nelson, respectfully, the bill does not match with your intent. You're killing the bill. You're killing the program. No one says there's going to be a supplemental budget next year. You are very presumptive if you say, well, we'll just figure it out for new funding next year of the biennium. Who is to say we might not be in a deficit by then? You know, if I'm wrong, point me to where the funding is going to come from in a bill that's in the hopper or has been introduced. I haven't seen it. You know, you've got folks like Ms. Zeman, Ms. Porter, and Ms. Ulysses who implore you to maintain that funding, as we do. Because out of all of the programs that we fund around here, think about the success that they just testified to, and we're thinking about cutting them off at their knees. And the folks that rely upon this program, you're going to tell them no. You're going to tell them you're not important. This program, not important. $10, $325,000. Around here, that's money that we lose euphemistically in the couch cushions. But to a family that goes to the Egan Farmers Market or the one on 42 in Rosemont, it's part of their next week's dinner plan. And you're going to say that doesn't matter. These folks don't matter. This program matters. Think long and hard about how you vote on this amendment.
All right. Thank you, Representative Albright. Any other questions? Chair Nelson, comments before the amendment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As I said at the beginning, I believe this is a good program. I've spoken with both Chair Poppe and Chair Liebling about this. They both agree that if funding is the funding source, the funding is in the wrong place, that it should come out of either one of their committees. And they've committed to me that they're going to work on trying to get this worked out so that it's in the proper place. As the farmers that came down here and spoke and talked about this and how it helps the farmers, that's why it should probably be in the agriculture budget. It should have been included in their base. Why it was included in ours 2 years ago, I was told different reasons why it was, but it ended up in our budget. But it's not something the state government finance bill is about. What are we going to do next to put programs in? I want to get Highway 14 built in southern Minnesota, so I'm going to include that in my bill, a highway funding bill, because that's a program I like. The state government finance bill is about funding government, funding the House of Representatives, funding the Senate, funding the governor's office, funding the backbone structures that make our government work so that these programs can be funded and work properly. So that's why the amendment, I mean, I heard from the original bill, I heard the people talking. I heard them come to me. That's why I funded it for the first year, and I told we're directing the government, the governor's staff,
to come forward with a plan for funding this going on in the future in the proper place so it can be coordinated with the other benefits like SNAP, which, again, is out of the Agricultural Committee. So, members, I say no. I oppose the DE2 amendment. The DE1 amendment is my solution to get this moving forward and keep it going for this year and work to getting it funded for the ongoing in the future from the proper place.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative Keel did request a roll call, so roll call has been requested.
Mr. Chair, can I make one more comment?
Yes, Representative Keel.
I'll make it quick. You know, I think about this. Why in the humanities? Why? But we talk about all the nationalities in this state. Humanities affects, it talks about our heritage, our background, humanities. It is connecting Native American, Hmong, all of those different groups. And I can't help but think, I wasn't part of this when it was started in this committee, but I can't help but think that this is a really important area for it to be in, because that is what directs the historical background of the foods that are grown in Minnesota and the possibility of new things. Thank you.
Okay. I'm getting a few more requests to speak on the amendment. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just to Representative Keel's comment about the humanities. You know, the humanities, I just looked up their mission. And their mission is building a thoughtful, literate, and engaged society. I think most of us in this room really would support the humanities and that effort. But this bill and this amendment is about food. It's not necessarily about building engaged conversation or about building thoughtful literacy about different cultures and diversity. It's about a very basic human need, which is food. And it's why I support the amendment to get this into the proper committee, to make sure that food is available for every person. And it's not, this is not an issue about only singling out certain cultures or only picking selected people to receive a benefit. It's about food, and so that's why I'm submitting this, or supporting the author in this initiative. So not for this amendment, but for the authors.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, so if this comes out of the base, right, the base is not being contested by the Senate. This is in the base. This is not something that they're moving to change. There's a distinct chance that this may not go into another committee. I mean, there's no – is there a bill to put it in Chair Liebling bills, or is there a bill to put it in Chair Poppy's? I'm just asking because that should be something that is an important decision for your members before they take a vote on this DE.
Chair Nelson?
Mr. Chair and members, like I said, if the second half of the amendment – of the DE2 amendment, excuse me, puts it to the Commissioner of Health and Human Services and the Commissioner of Agriculture to submit a report to telling us where this money should come from and where the proper place to put this, and it directs them to come up with the funding source and move this forward. So, and that's what the second half of the amendment does. Again, I believe this is an important program, but again, it's not about funding. It's not about not funding this program, or not about getting rid of this program. It's about where the money should come from. It's not; it shouldn't be coming out of government, state government finance. It's a money that should be coming out of either Health and Human Services or the Agriculture Committee.
All right, Chair Nelson,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, real quick, Mr. Yeah. Representative Nash.
Well, Mr. Chair, that wasn't properly answered. I mean, there is no bill that puts this in there, and I just think that if you want to make a change, that's certainly your purview, but make it later. Take the enactment date out or change it to a different year, but folks are depending on this, and this is in the base budget. You're fiddling with the base when no one's actually contesting it in the Senate. No one feels the burning need to do that. I would hate to think that this was some part of a budget game that's going to go into your target, but I don't know. I mean, this is
This is heartless. This is heartless. Vote for the DE2.
Mr. Chair.
Just real quick, I think in response to Representative Nash's point, the report does require draft legislation to implement the recommended changes. So that is part of the DE. It's the last sentence of the DE2 amendment.
No, Mr. Chair, where is that amendment? Where is that language?
No. That's part of the what's going to come out of their report, is that there would be draft language.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I'm a guy, so I'm a fixer. So here's a novel thought, and I'm hoping that the chair and the author of the bill would indulge me for an oral amendment to the DE1. The DE1.
We're on the DE1.
The DE1? Oh, the
DE2. Minus one.
Oh, we are on the DE1, the Keel Amendment.
Okay, rather than moving it, a recommendation. You're looking to have lines 1.8 through 1.14 added to the bill. Why not incorporate the DE1 onto the DE2? And we both are amicable in terms of we maintain funding for the folks that need it most, and you get your report.
Mr. Chair, this is not about a report, getting a report and getting a, but it's about getting the governor's staff to come up with the money to fund this going forward and put it in the proper base budget, not our base budget.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Nelson. With that, we will move to the roll call on the DE1 amendment.
Chair Nelson.
No.
Vice Chair Carlson.
No.
Representative Albright.
Yes.
Representative Acomb.
No.
Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Freiberg.
No.
Representative Green.
Yes.
Representative Hertas.
Yes.
Representative Hewitt.
No.
Representative Keel.
Yes.
Representative Cleavorn.
No.
Representative Lippert.
No.
Representative Long.
No.
Representative Mason.
No.
Representative Nash.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Vogel.
Yes.
So with 7 ayes and 11 noes, the amendment does not pass. Okay. Moving on to the amended bill itself, I have Representative Acomb first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson. I appreciate the hearing tonight because I think I learned a lot about a program that I didn't otherwise know much about. And so one of our testifiers tonight talked about this program being a win-win for our community as well as our farmers, and I think they demonstrated that that's really the case. And I know that the farmers market in my community is a festive place and one that is celebrated, and so I think an opportunity to be able to provide that to a program like this that can provide that opportunity to more families and more people is fabulous. I think this is a great program. I was really excited to hear about the wonderful things going on in Grand Rapids and being able to double down on the effort that is being done here at the state. I think that's a great way to collaborate and help those who need it. And we all think that healthy food is good for us. This is a great program. I fully support the program. Mm-hmm. I want it to be in the place it's going to, that it makes the most sense. It makes sense to be in ag. It makes sense to be in Health and Human Services. And so a strong supporter of the program. I will fight hard to continue it. I think it makes sense in a different committee.
Thank you, Representative. Next on the list, I have Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And obviously, this isn't easy. And I think the other side is, you know, throwing some stuff at us with the idea that this is hard, because we fully support the program and believe that the longevity of the program is best served being in the right place.
I sat through state government last year, and the number that came to mind was that when we talked about funding this program, it came at a cost. There were substantial cuts proposed to other parts of our state government. I remember a 35% cut being proposed to the Department of Human Rights, which impacts all of our districts across the state. So it's not that this didn't come, you know, in this committee. When we talk about state government finance isn't a huge target, oftentimes we would see it come with a cut. And so, you know, the idea that this needs to be where it needs to be is, I think, well, is where is something we need to put it in the right place so we can fight for the funding in the right area. And I will continue to fight strongly, and I've talked to the advocates over the weekend and wanted to put forward a solution that didn't cut anybody off right away but gave us some time to find the proper place. Because if we're talking about, we have meaningful work we need to do with our state workers and with the programs that are out of this budget, and that's super important. Another thing, it got brought up that there's a farmer's market in my district that is served by this program. It's in Lincoln Park neighborhood. Let me tell you a little bit about the Lincoln Park neighborhood. If someone lives in the Lincoln Park neighborhood, you all know Duluth because you've all been there. Someone in my district lives an average of 11 years less than someone in Representative Schultz's district just a few miles away. And that's in the Lincoln Park neighborhood. And so that's also, when we talk about the people that benefit of this program, I hope my colleagues across the aisle support the increase in MFIB. I hope they support the increase when we're talking about paid family leave, because these are the same people that go to this farmer's market, that rely on these bucks, that rely on these other programs for their livelihood. They rely on the mass transit to get them there. They rely on CCAP rates to be able to take their kids to daycare. This is about the intersection of all things that have to do with anti-poverty and inequalities. So when we're talking about Lincoln Park and we're talking about Duluth and we're talking about farmers market bucks, we're talking about all those systems combined. We don't often get to talk about that in state government finance, and I think that's why this program is so well served in these places where we're talking about the intersection of what it takes for people to live their lives, to get to and from work, to eat healthy food, to access SNAP, MFIB, CCAP, all the other things that these families that use these market bucks rely on too. So this is hard. This is absolutely hard. This is not a fun vote for us to take today. I don't think anybody wants to be doing this, but sometimes you have to do what's right. And so we need to put this program where it needs to be.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we just heard sometimes we have to do what's right. What would be right for a bill working on this topic is in the same bill, put it into the base somewhere that when you're taking it out of the base here. That's the right thing to do. And frankly, you could have sort of allowed for that to give another year of do the report, don't take it out of the base until you know where it's going to go, and so you know it's existing. So you're killing it off at this date with the future promise that it'll be added. Why don't you just wait and in the same bill put it on the base there, take it off the base here, because then you ensure the continuity is there. You don't leave anything up for guessing or what if. That is the right thing to do. And frankly, I had hoped that we could have done that, but apparently we can't. I wish that we could lay this on the table and have some discussion with the other chairs and say, can we do this? Because it should be a priority. And that would be the right thing to do. But instead, we just, you know, too often we do something and cross our fingers that it's going to work out next year. You know, I'm usually optimistic, but I get more and more pessimistic that next year is going to bring a better result. So, yeah. Let's look at doing the right thing.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Just to echo some comments that have been made earlier, I, too, care deeply about equity. It's why I'm here. I care deeply about local farmers and local foods. It's why I'm here. And I know that this program is very, very important. I know the difference it makes for low-income families and households, and the difference it makes for farmers who are growing foods for local communities. I know that. And I agree with Chair Nelson and Chair Poppy and Chair Liebling that this funding is not in the right spot. And I want, we need to have funding coming out of the right buckets so that state government can function as well as possible for the good of our whole state. So I will be working very closely with Chair Nelson and Chair Liebling and Chair Poppy to sustain and strengthen this very, very important program, because I know how important it is, and in the right spot, it will be even stronger than it is now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. Representative Nash.
Well, one last try, Mr. Chair. Members, you don't know where this is going to go. There's no guarantee. We've heard that. It's a conversation. Oh, maybe we'll put it over here. Maybe we'll put it in this bill. Maybe we'll put it in a different bill. Well, guess what? It's in this base right now. And you don't know what your other chairs are going to be able to get done. You have no idea. There's no guarantee, to Representative Quam's point. So if you make a move to cut this, you run a risk of losing it all. And I want you to think about the message that it sends to the people that you represent, that we all represent, many of whom we don't even know if they use this or not, because they don't talk about it. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But I think that this sends a pretty strong message, so I would encourage you to recognize that there is no guarantee that this is going to go into either of the other chair's bills. Representative Nelson, I don't think you gave us a guarantee that that's going to be the case. So think carefully before you vote yes. I'm recommending a no vote.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think to your point, Representative Nash, that we don't ever know what's going to happen. I'm new to this committee, and I haven't served here before, and I feel as though I'm taking a vote because someone else didn't want to do the hard work before to put it in the right committee, and I don't know who that person would be. I'm not accusing anyone. I'm just saying, when we are just asking for it to be in a committee where it would be in the right place and to be on that base so that we have the accounting where it needs to be and that all of the programs can be working in conjunction with each other, I think that's a really good thing. The people I know on our side of the committee who have been asking all of the same questions that are being talked about, how will we make sure that the food is available to people? We care deeply about that, and we'll be working very hard to make sure that continued funding is happening in the right committee. And I invite anyone who wants to work with me, and I'll be working with Representative Lippert and others who are interested, to show up in mass to say, hey, we need to get this funded. It is important to the people that it serves, and we all know how basic food is to a person's life and dignity. So I invite all of us to work together to make sure that this happens in the right committees, and I welcome you to that work. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Nelson, it is your intention to lay this bill over for inclusion.
That was the motion, yes, to lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Correct.
Okay. So I just want to reiterate what everybody else is saying, is that we all believe very strongly in this program. It is offered at my home farmer's market in Bloomington, and as is the case in many other farmer's market, the leftover produce at the end ends up being contributed to the local food shelf at Beef a couple of blocks away. So I don't think anybody at the table is opposed to the continuation of this program. We're all strongly supporting it, and we'll support, you know, any good way forward we can find with the bill laid over.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Last two names, I have Representative Keel and then Representative Albright, and then lastly, Chair Nelson to close us out. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to point out some of the conversation here. I'm really disappointed that we didn't consider Representative Albright's motion, because I think it would be important to continue this program as is while having that conversation. I know there's some interlock in agriculture. I get that. Representatives, what you need to understand is we can all plan this, and next session, and I've been an ag since I've shown up here, and being a farmer, I know that all of a sudden the plans we made to shift something ends up changing because we had the swine flu. So a lot of funds went that direction instead. And I can see this falling off the truck, really, the vegetable truck, really fast. And the intentions of making sure it stays where it needs to stay or exist, it worries me about moving it without having a direction, especially in the second year of our biennium. Things happen. Health and Human Services is the same way. Something could happen. We lose the funding, and we end up not being able to do it. It's not like we're talking about millions of dollars here. I know, you know, in my world, farming, $325,000 is a lot of money, but in state government, it isn't quite as much. But it's really, I really think we need to think. I'm imploring one more time to really think about this, Chair Nelson, that maybe this is something that we should work on moving, but in the meantime, leave it in this budget so that it is covered for the biennium, because this is when we do the financials. We don't know what next year will bring, and I want you to all remember that it changes so quickly, and something happens, and our efforts have to go elsewhere, and this is something that's important to our citizens. It's important to our young farmers, our new farmers, our new different culture farmers that are, if you've had a chance to go out by the ammunitions and tour those gardens that I've had an opportunity to see that are massive, and there are many people that have gardens there that produce a lot. They have a lot of produce, a lot of unique things, are very successful, and it is their livelihood. And I just, it's not just the livelihood, it's making sure we feed people. So thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, one of the things, and this is not a play on words, but right now the fiscal agent for this is through the Minnesota Humanities Center. Well, we're talking about humanity. We're literally talking about the difference between feeding a family with nutritious food, or as I've said before, relying upon starch and processed foods, which are empty calories for people that then might not have the energy to do well on their math exam the next morning, or be so tired that they can't do their homework at night. Or the worry of a mom, a single mom, about am I doing right by my kids nutritionally or otherwise in terms of their mental and physical development. Representative Lippert and others, good intentions don't fill the empty cupboards. And all the promises that you make about working hard and with, bipartisan support to get this moved in the next year of this biennium, that's, I think, unfortunately false hope for these folks. Because, one, you don't know if there's going to be a supplemental budget. It's the policy year. It's already in the base. And as Representative Nash has said, just leave the appropriation alone and go forward with a study in terms of where you want it to be put. But to that point, I heard someone suggest that, you know, why did it end up in the Humanities Center? Well, I know, because I was on the committee with Representative Chair Sarah Anderson when she did this. And it was very intentional, because she knew exactly how the Humanities Center would handle the money. It wouldn't be lost in a massive budget like you have in DHS. It wouldn't be lost amongst all the other things in the Ag Department. They have no objection to handling this money. And they do it very, very efficiently and take very good care of the people that they serve. So it was put in the best place. And to the folks behind this side of the table, they don't care where it is placed. That's not their problem. What their problem is providing $10 and match to provide a family who might otherwise go without fresh produce. So the rigmarole about making a decision in terms of where it's placed, the intentionality has already been accomplished. And it is where it should be for the very reason that it was put there, so it doesn't get lost in the kerfuffle of other budgets. Members, we're talking about humanity and we're talking about food deserts, things that, you know, we can talk up around this table as if they don't mean anything, but to the folks that at the Second Harvest and to the food shelves, those are lives, there's a faces, and those are bodies that need nutrition and good nutrition. So I would urge you to think wisely about this bill and this initiative. And even more so, you're not even going to take a vote on it, because it's going to be included for possible inclusion, which means then you got to fight to keep it in the bill here and then probably take it to conference committee against the Senate and with the governor. And we've seen no funding for it, so you've got policy but no funding. So answer me that. And I'll be looking curiously upon how this, for the sake of the people that it serves, goes forward. I hope that you do well by them.
All right. Thank you, Representative Albright. Chair Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the good discussion. Again, like I said, my concern with this going forward is in the state government finance bill. It's not something that it's part of state government finance. And in a future year when we've had if we have a budget deficit, this would probably be one of the first things that the people in state government finance would shut off, because it's not part of our core mission. The core mission of this, like I said, belongs either in health and human services or in agriculture, or probably partly in both. But members, in state government finance, if there's cuts that have to be made during a budget year, I've lived through that in this legislature, and I've lived through it where members were chairs are running around jumping and trying to find every little penny they can to cut out of their budget so they can fund the core mission of their departments, of their budget. So, members, that's what this bill is about. And with that, members, hope we can lay it over for possible inclusion.
With that, Chair Nelson renews his motion to lay over House File 2751 for possible inclusion.
Yep.
Next, and last on our agenda for tonight is House File 2750. Chair Nelson, would you like to move your bill?
I'll move House File 2750 for possible inclusion.
All right, so moved. And if you want to proceed with describing your bill for us, please.
And Mr. Chair, members, what this bill is similar to the last bill, but this has to do with the Film Board. My understanding is 2 years ago, during the special session, the Film Board, they had left money out. They forgot to put it in the jobs bill, which is where this is traditionally funded out of. And so instead of opening that bill back up, so it had already been passed and signed, they put the money into our bill, the government operations bill, so that it would be funded. And members, this is the similar thing that we're going to move this. Didn't have time to get the amendment made up to move it to the language in the second half of the previous bill, but I'm going to try and get an amendment made up for that to fund that bill to again get into the jobs bill. And I've spoke with Chair Mahoney of the Jobs Committee, and he agrees that yes, this is where it should have been, and he understands why it didn't end up there last year and why it didn't end up in his base. And so we're going to work to make sure that happens and this money gets funded.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. There's no amendments to the bill. Member questions, comments? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson. So I think the jobs bill was actually released today. And is the appropriation in the jobs bill now?
Chair Nelson.
The base budget for that committee is in the jobs bill, yes. But I don't think it's the full amount that's between the two of them, the two committees from last year. But the base budget for the film board is in the jobs bill.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if there's anyone in the audience that could verify that.
Yes. If you would please approach, introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Melody Bahan. I'm the executive director of Minnesota Film and TV.
And if you want to provide some commentary with the question that was posed?
Yes, the half of the operations budget for our organization is in the jobs bill, and half is in this before this committee. This was something that I became executive director of this organization in July of 2017. So this situation that we find ourselves in occurred before I took over. My understanding is that it was a conversation between then Senate Finance Chair Senator Cohen and Representative Sarah Anderson that placed half of the operating budget for our organization in this department. So Deed was unaware of this.
Half the budget.
Yes. And so what is in Deed's budget is half of our operations. Might I just say a few words about what the organization does and
briefly, yes.
Yeah. Just so I want everyone to understand that Minnesota Film and TV is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We are the only 501c3 nonprofit that serves as the state film commission. In the majority of states, the film commissions are state agencies. And when I found out about this bill on Thursday night, I started doing research, and believe me, the amount of money that every other state spends on their film commission is far above what Minnesota is spending to fund the operations of this very small nonprofit that's serving the same function. As I said, I found out about this on Thursday evening. Deed was not aware of it. We are not included in the budget, and my concern is that without being in another budget, our funding will get cut in half, and I will be forced to lay off staff, and we will not be able to fulfill our mission.
Okay. Questions for the testifier?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier or in coordination with the author of the bill. So, is it my understanding that you have half of your funding appropriated in some other bill right now, and you're looking for the remainder through the House File 2750?
Yes. I'm sorry. I caught Melody. What was your last
name? Bahan.
One more time?
Bahan.
Bahan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair,
if Ms. Roberts could explain, I believe there was a cut to the film board 4 years ago, or it might have been a lot longer than that. And then she's shaking her head. I'll let her speak.
Mr. Chair, I think what we're talking about are changes that were made in the 2017 session. The film board has always been in the jobs committee. The funding may have fluctuated over the years. They've had a grant program that comes and goes, but it has always been in the jobs program, jobs committee indeed. In the 2017 session, the jobs bill passed in the regular session, and included a House position that cut the film board funding in half. So that passed in regular session with a cut to the film board. And then the state government bill had not passed, went into special session, and as it was being debated on the Senate floor, the Senate added an amendment to add the $162,000 back, but could only do it through the Department of Administration because that wasn't the place to put it in the state government bill.
So that's why it's here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so then it's continuing to have this where it goes through in the base through Department of Administration, but would be immediately transferred through a grant or an interagency agreement to DEED. And so this program, this bill will eliminate the funding that is going to Department of Administration.
And Representative Albright.
So are we backfilling then? Is that what we're doing? Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, no. It's the bill reduces the funding that goes through Department of Administration. That's all it does.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Chair Nelson.
And like I said, the House cut the funding for that in the past, and because of the conference committee put it in the state government finance and the admin, that's why this is here. And again, this should be funded in the deed in the jobs committee, and we're just trying to put that back to where it.
Okay, Representative Quam, you're next on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the freshman members of this committee. The convolutions that we've just heard about is part of the reason I'm pessimistic about crossing the fingers on the previous bill. Because at the end of the budget process, you know, things happen, and we're trying to fix that now. So just a bit of caution, and hopefully the same author will be able to find a way to make it even better before we actually vote on our division's bill.
Seeing no other member questions, Chair Nelson.
Mr. Chair and members, like I said, we're trying to put things in the proper funding place so that, again, if this had been in jobs, if the base had been put in jobs instead of coming from two places, the money would be in the jobs bill. Have different pots of money funding the same things all over our budgets causes confusion, it causes things to get missed, and causes, in some cases, double funding for things. This should be in the jobs bill, and that's what this bill is basically doing.
So with that, Chair Nelson renews his motion to lay over House File 2750 for possible inclusion. Do I get to do that? All right, and with that, this meeting is adjourned.